I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Today is April the 8th, 2020. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Before we begin with the regular program, I want to address the issue of communications disconnect with each other and how we can more effectively get the message out, the need to stay at home in controlling the coronavirus crisis. It's not the fault of anyone in the communications breakdown. Local officials are not effectively communicating about the need to adhere strictly to the stay-at-home guidelines to young people who are getting their information online. The reported incidents of young people partying during spring break while the nation is fighting to control the coronavirus outbreak are not isolated instances. The general response when young people are apprised of the coronavirus crisis is, "I didn't know that," or "I never heard that." Young people don't watch ABC, CBS, Fox, CNN, nor they read newspapers. They watch YouTube influencers. They are on Instagram, watching videos and following certain people. Near 80% are aged 13 to 35. That's where the young people are. Governors, mayors, commissioners, sheriffs, and all local officials need to do their research and go to where young people are, instead of just holding press conferences and communicating through online magazines and on Facebook. We need to better understand and know what mediums young people are using. Young people aren't reading the local newspapers, nor are they watching mainstream television or any of the other major news organizations. They are on YouTube, Snapchat, Instagram, and other similar social sites. The disconnect is a two-way issue. There is shared responsibility. However, at this time, the mainstream community has to take the initiative to reach out to the younger population on the online forums. How do we get to this state of communication disconnect? Well, that's for another discussion for another day. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM, on the Internet, and PCRadioShow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. There is a new Windows 10 update with serious problems. There are definitely many flaws and serious problems with all updates that Microsoft has released for Windows 10. After all the news of recent problems, Microsoft seems to have yet another case in hand, and this is with Knowledge Base 454-1335. That's KB454-1335. The update has started to show serious flaws, and there are complaints from users. The case of problems in Windows 10 have been accumulating. With each update, new failures and problems arise in situations where they were expected to solve only problems. The most recent case came from KB454-1335. This was released in March the 24th, which is very recent, with the purpose of correcting a set of problems that had been going on for some time that needed to be solved. It was an optional update, but it promised a lot. What has now been revealed in various support channels has put the trust in this improvement launched by Microsoft in doubt. Apparently, it affects only a limited group of users, but it has a high impact on Windows 10. The complaints mainly focus on Windows 10 crashes when using games and the appearance of several blue screens when playing YouTube videos. There are also reports of high CPU consumption and problems in Windows 10 interface. Microsoft does not yet have a solution. Being an optional update, the solution is to remove it from the system, returning to previous problems that dealt with games and just avoid the games for now. These are naturally smaller and easier to handle. The failures that have now emerged have, above all, a greater impact. Microsoft's situation is really complicated regarding Windows 10 updates. The software giant does not foresee a solution to this problem as it has not yet had official knowledge of this situation. We'll have to see how Microsoft will correct this new problem. And a word of advice for everyone. Remember, in this period of time, do your regular backups. And another part to it is, when you do backups, make sure you know how to restore from your backups. Make sure that the protection setting for the Windows operating system is on. You will find that if you need help at this time, it won't be that readily available since everyone's been asked to stay at home and many of the support outlets are closed. Why is Zoom so popular? Seemingly, everyone knows about Zoom now. Parents, co-workers, friends, grandparents, and neighbors. The video conferencing software company that went public last year is having a moment during the pandemic. People have flocked to the service to keep up with friends, build digital clubs, and even host weddings. However, in this time of immense growth, researchers and journalists have scrutinized the app and found multiple security and privacy risks. People are realizing the free app might actually come with the cost of giving up their personal data. The app's main selling point, at least to the broader consumer world, is that it offers free 40-minute conference calls with up to 100 attendees. It's easy to use, and people don't need a login to access a meeting, and the interface is relatively intuitive. However, those same features put people at risk. Zoom bombing, for one, has taken advantage of Zoom's system of randomly generated ID access codes and lack of required passwords to join a call. People drop into Zoom calls that aren't their own and broadcast offensive material, like pornography. One automated tool developed by security researchers can find 100 Zoom meeting IDs in an hour and information for nearly 2,400 Zoom meetings in a single day of scans, just as an example of how easy it is to be able to find meetings to join. Zoom says passwords have been enabled by default since late last year, but many people still aren't using them. That's not the only risk with Zoom. The company also has an issue with the company directory setting that could leak user emails and photos, and Zoom has confirmed that video calls on the app aren't end-to-end encrypted like the company claims. The company has since announced a 90-day freeze on releasing new features and will focus on fixing privacy and security issues. People continue to use Zoom because it's easy and free, but its competitors are making moves to catch up. Journalists, researchers, and regulators have noticed its many security and privacy problems. Zoom has responded with a surprisingly good plan for next steps, but talk is cheap. Zoom will have to deliver to make sure it's secure and safe to use. New York City schools told not to use Zoom for distance learning amid the security concerns. Teachers in public schools in the New York City system have been told not to use Zoom video conferencing technology for distance learning amid security and privacy concerns. Zoom has been in the spotlight as the world scrambles to contain the coronavirus outbreak, and millions of people are now working from home. In addition to using the video conferencing for work, Zoom is also being used by schools for distance learning. With the growing use of video conferencing services, however, the risk of hacking has also been highlighted. The New York City Department of Education has received reports of issues impacting Zoom privacy and security. The Department of Education will no longer permit the use of Zoom at this time. Instead, schools were advised to switch to Microsoft Teams collaboration technology. Principals were reportedly told that Google Classroom, which is designed to help students and teachers organize assignments and collaborate, is safe to use, but not for video and voice conferencing. Citing the same memo, the New York Daily News reported that education officials are working to get clearance for Google's video conferencing. The FBI recently warned of so-called Zoom bombing or video conference hacking. The FBI has received multiple reports of conferences being disrupted by pornographic and/or hate images and threatening language. With all these stories of Zoom bombing and Zoom hacks, can you still use Zoom? Yes, as long as you exercise some caution. If you're hosting a Zoom meeting, you need to watch out for a few things. A public meeting link is public, so don't share it with anyone you don't trust. The same goes for your personal meeting ID. This is essentially a personal phone number that people can drop in on at any time. Set up a password for participants to verify their entry before entering, if practical. Refrain from discussing financial and personal information. When you're in the meeting, you'll want to manage screen sharing by ensuring that you're the only person in control of the meeting. To do this, click on Who Can Share and confirm that Host is the only button clicked. Manage participants by ensuring only signed-in participants can join the call. This way, you know who people are if they're behaving badly. Set two-factor authentication. Remove unwanted or disruptive participants. Disable video for participants and disable private chat. Say something if you see something. You can report unwanted activity, harassment, and cyber attacks to Zoom directly. Just remember that the weakest link has always been the human user of a product. Featuring Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, VPM Explanations for Business and Home.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for business. This is where I give you tidbits from my current and also 30 years of past experience of being an IT professional. And this is one of the topics which I knew was going to be coming up, and I've had a couple of different people ask me about VPNs, virtual private networks. We're getting exposed to the idea of virtual private networks, of VPNs, through our remote access of network resources. Now, let's establish what a virtual private network does. What it does is it essentially sets up encoded transmission of information between your computer and the remote computer. Now, there's a couple of different ways along the way that we deal with this. In the business world, what this amounts to is it locks down all of the information going from your home PC to the servers at the office. Now, when you are dealing with this in the office environment, you are dealing with this based on hardware that's already set up or software that's set up, and you connect up to your remote location. All of the information between your home and the office and vice versa is all encrypted. It's all protected. It's all locked down. Nobody can see what you are doing on the internet. Now, this does present some different little things. Now, when you are connected via the VPN, via this virtual private network, remember, all of that information is going from your personal PC or your work PC that's, you know, that's remote, your home, and it's going into the office and back and forth. Usual configurations have all of your internet traffic that you're doing on that same PC that's part of that virtual private network also goes through your office environment. For instance, and you may have experienced this, a lot of companies are saying, hey, look, if you are online, if you are doing the virtual private network, you're doing the VPN, that whole thing, when you're at lunch, log off of the VPN and do not do Facebook, YouTube, or any of that. None of the news stuff. Don't do any of that online through the VPN. The reason for that is it just hammers the internet connection that your business has running between your business and your home. So we need to stifle a lot of that. Of course, that means you're going to work harder because you're not on Facebook and you're not doing YouTube when you should be, oh yes, working. But that's another story for another day. There is a truly legitimate reason why we want you to do that. Now, Let's talk about a site-to-site VPN, because this also happens on occasion. A virtual private network, which is set up where you have four or five computers on one side, and you've got, you know, the hundreds of computers on the other side, and you have that isolated tunnel. You may have heard that term as well. It's the same kind of concept. It's still a VPN. It's still a virtual private network, and everything is protected. You are in an isolated realm. All of that information flying back and forth. But now, instead of just one computer, it's, you know, a half dozen computers, whatever it is. And that can be a hardware VPN. Again, it can also be, that's usually a hardware VPN, actually, I should say. The last kind of VPN, which I want to inform you of, and I want you to be aware of this, is you can actually utilize VPNs to protect your traffic between where you are at and the remote location. Now, it's only partially protected, and this is something that comes into play when you are in an airport or you're in your local Starbucks and you are getting coffee, or you're on a flight or whatever. Not so much these days, yes, but you get the idea. So what happens is it encrypts the communication at the local level. So you're connecting up to the VPN. You've got encrypted traffic going from your PC, your laptop that you've got right there, going off through the internet halfway across the world, or maybe even just a couple of states away. And then that information then goes out onto the internet. You may have heard a couple of these different companies that are out there: NordVPN, ExpressVPN. There's probably 100 different items. Look, don't get wrapped up into all of the different companies, whether it's Symantec or Express or CyberGhost or Nord or whatever. Look, they're all competitors. And what's happening is they're protecting a lot of your information going from point A to point B. Now, point C is your bank. So the information that goes from their location, where their servers are at, on over to your bank is unencrypted, but it's actually still encrypted in that you've got that HTTPS, that secure communication between your bank and yourself. So it does allow you some protection, some level of anonymity, some level of making sure the bad guys don't get your information by eavesdropping in the middle of course, in the middle of the Starbucks or the airport or wherever. But it's still it's still a pretty good deal. There are a number of different VPNs out there. I'm not going to actually pick one for you, because each one has their own ups and downs. And yeah, I've tried a number of the ones I've suggested, and I'm not exactly thrilled with any of them to 100% status. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. What will cut down on robocalls? The Federal Communications Commission estimates that the average American receives 10 robocalls a day. Unwanted phone calls have exploded in the last few years, and it's an annoyance that robs you of your time and attention. One of the most frustrating things is not knowing why you're getting these calls or where they're coming from. There isn't much you can do to stop scam calls. Unfortunately, you can put your number on the FTC Do Not Call Registry, which prevents telemarketers from calling, but only legitimate businesses are going to respect it. The Do Not Call Registry only facilitates telemarketers with access to over 200 million legitimate phone numbers. Scammers are already breaking the law, and many of them are based outside the United States anyway, so they probably don't care about the penalties for violating the Do Not Call list. Robocalls are simply pre-recorded messages. They've been in use for a long time for valid reasons, and according to the Federal Trade Commission, robocalls are acceptable for purposes such as to let you know your flight's been canceled, reminders about an appointment, or messages about a delayed school opening. However, the FTC strictly forbids businesses calling people to promote the sale of any goods or services. So why are so many spam and scam calls happening these days? Spoofing. Spoofing circumvents your ability to truly identify who's calling. Spoofing is a process where a caller ensures that their number shows up differently on call ID. For starters, it's becoming much easier thanks to advances in technology. Telemarketers are no longer bounded by landlines. Why do telecom companies enable and allow caller IDs to be spoofed? The quick answer is because there are legitimate reasons to allow customers to do this. The most typical is when a company wants to set all outgoing calls to show the main company number and number even when the call originates from a direct inbound dial line. One of the strangest things you may have noticed about robocalls is that they come from numbers that look a lot like your own. The area code and even the first three digits might match yours, leading you to think you're getting a call from someone nearby, like a local business or coworker. Then you answer only to hear pre-recorded message or human scammers on the other end. This is called spoofing, a process which a call ensures that their phone numbers shows up differently on call ID. The technology itself is legal and it has legitimate uses. For instance, if you need to make a business call on a personal phone and want your office number to show up on the other end. However, when it comes to telemarketing, the Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, states that companies must use their own phone numbers. And if they don't, how do you stop it? An unfortunate side effect of scammers spoofing phone numbers is that they might use a number currently in use, which can result in some headaches for the owner of that number. If a scammer disguises their number with your own to target someone else in your area, that person might call you back thinking that your number is a scammer. If you answer one of these calls, a few things can happen. A pre-recorded message might play offering you fabulous prizes like a free vacation or an attractive service like reducing the interest rate on the credit card, inviting you to press a number and speak to a live operator. They could also make a more sinister approach, impersonating law enforcement and scaring you into paying them. Although these scams may seem ridiculous, they can work. The aggressive nature of the call can make people panic, and office scammers will have information on their target, like a home address, to make the call more legitimate. Given that individual scammers can cheaply make hundreds and even thousands of calls a day, they only need relatively few people to bite. One of the strangest things you may have noticed about robocalls is that they come from numbers that look a lot like your own. The area code and even the first three digits might match yours, leading you to think that you're getting a call from someone nearby, like a local business or coworker. Then you answer only to hear a pre-recorded message or human scammer on the other end. This is called spoofing, a process by which a caller ensures that their number shows up differently on call ID. The technology itself is legal, and it has legitimate uses, such as if you need to make a business call on a personal phone and want your office number to show up on the other end. However, when it comes to telemarketing, the Federal Communications Commission states that companies must use their own phone numbers. This has not happened. An unfortunate side effect of scammers spoofing phone numbers is that they might use a number currently in use, which can result in some headaches if you were the owner of that number. If a scammer disguises their number with your own number to target someone in your area, that person might call you back thinking your number is a scammer's. If you answer one of these calls, a few things could happen. A pre-recorded message playback offering you fabulous prizes like a free vacation or an attractive service like reducing the interest rates on a credit card and inviting you to press a number to speak to a live operator. This could also take a more sinister approach, impersonating law enforcement and scaring you into paying them. Although these scams may seem ridiculous, they can work. The aggressive nature of the call can make people panic, and often scammers will have information on their target, like a home address, to make the call seem more legitimate. Given that individual scammers can cheaply make hundreds or even thousands of calls a day, they only need relatively few people to bite. What can you do to protect yourself? Although agencies like the FTC and the FCC are cracking down on scammers, the wave is only giving to swell as scam calls rose from 3.7% of total calls in 2017 to 29.2% in 2018, and that number is projected to reach 44.6% of all calls in 2019. The best thing to do is simply avoid answering calls from unknown numbers. Blocking numbers isn't always effective, as scammers switch phone numbers frequently. The best thing to do is simply avoid answering calls from unknown numbers, especially if the number is suspiciously similar to your own. If you answer a call from a scammer, do not give up any personal information, even if they already seem to know a lot about you. Remember that if a government or a law enforcement agency needs to contact you, they'll send you a notice in writing to show up at your door. Lastly, while it may seem fun to answer and mess around with a scammer on the other end, there are a few videos on YouTube of people doing this. It can cause more problem than it's worth. For one thing, merely by answering, you're letting the caller know that your phone number belongs to someone who's willing to answer, which could lead to more calls down the line. Even worse, there are scams in which the caller tries to get victims to answer questions, recording their voice when they answer. The scammer then used the victim's voice signature to pretend to be the consumer and authorize fraudulent charge via telephone. The best way to avoid getting scammed is not to talk to the scammers at all. There is no universal fix for this kind of scam. It would seem that if spoofing is disabled, however, robocalls and spammers would be greatly reduced as telemarketers could easily be identified. Although legitimate use would be affected, the greater benefit of its discontinuance outweighs the benefits of its legitimate use. It's rolling back the clock on spoofing capability, operating on what was available before. Why isn't there legislation or regulation banning spoofing? You probably have guessed it by now that spoofing is legal because politicians are exempt from observing the Do Not Call registry. That's one primary reason why little has been done to stem or stop robocalls. The Do Not Call registry, created by the Federal Trade Commission, was designated to allow consumers to opt out of telemarketing calls. Companies have access to the National Do Not Call registry to know who the business cannot legally contact. The registry now includes more than 221 million phone numbers. Having your number on the Do Not Call list will not necessarily stop all unwanted phone calls. Indeed, the FTC does not block calls. Businesses can ignore the Do Not Call registry and call consumers anyway. However, it is illegal. Generally, legitimate companies don't want to do this, and good actors adhere to the registry's guidelines. Scammers, however, often ignore the registry and call anyway. The Do Not Call registry also allows consumers, including those who are already on the list, to report unwanted calls and robocalls. Make sure to note the number displayed on your caller ID and report this as well. While many scammers use false caller ID information, having the number that appeared to have called you is a place to start. Who is exempt from the Do Not Call registry? Not all calls from companies or organizations are illegal under the FTC guidelines, even if your number is on the Do Not Call list. The following calls are allowed. Political calls, of course, why not? Charitable calls, debt collection calls, purely informational calls, and surveys. Notably, even though these kinds of calls are exempt from the registry rules, they still cannot legally include any sort of sales pitch. While charitable calls are allowed by the FTC, telemarketers calling on behalf of charities are prohibited under the Do Not Call rules. Any company with whom you have done business or sought to do business in the past 18 months can also legally call you. After the 18 months are up, however, they are no longer allowed to do so. Since the FCC won't act, Congress finally moves on robocalls by passing Half Decent Trace Act, and it only took 7 years of consumer hell to get this far. By the way, the Trace Act is T-R-A-C-E-D if you want to look it up. Congress has finally acted on the scourge of robocalls, with House of Representatives passing the Trace Act by 417 votes for and 3 against, with 11 not voting. Senators earlier passed the linked Senate Bill 151, meaning both halves of Congress have approved the anti-robocall law. The new law is likely to prove effective. It gives the Federal Communications Commission, that's the FCC, the power to, among other things, ensure people no longer receive unwanted calls or text messages from a caller using an unauthenticated number, with fines and other penalties as a beating stick. Blocking dodgy calls from strangers is the emphasis. Just as importantly, the law recognizes that the companies, often scammers, that currently make 48 billion spoof calls every year are going to try to find ways around the rules, and adds the requirements that regulators periodically report back to Congress on the issue, identifying how effectively the problem is being tackled and identifying any new laws or authorization that may be required to keep a lid on it. It's been 7 years since the problem of robocalls became so significant in America that the Federal Trade Commission offered a $50,000 cash prize to anyone that could come up with a way to block them. At the time, the director of the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection said that the winner of our challenge will become a national hero, highlighting just how infuriating it had become. The prize was eventually split between two companies. But despite seemingly endless threats from the FTC and FCC about how it was coming down hard on robocallers, the problem only has grown. It has gotten so bad that robocalls have been the number one consumer complaint lodged with the FCC for several years. The FCC has periodically made noises about what it was doing, levying huge fines that it never bothered to actually enforce once it got the headlines it wanted. It has promised to publicly shame robocallers and even told people to ditch their landline, but nothing cracked the problem. The dirty truth is that phone companies continue to make a small fortune from robocalling activities that they don't want to see that revenue dry up. The telco industry purposely stalled and delayed efforts to tackle the problem. The FCC, disingenuous of announcing big headline fines, one that was for $120 million, and swearing it was doing everything possible while not using any of its powers to force change onto the industry. Whenever pressed hard, the FCC has shoved the issue onto Congress, claiming it is doing everything within its authority, a claim that drove one FCC commissioner and dozens of state attorney generals to despair. But finally, the problem became so huge that Congress was stirred into action. The FCC responded by finally approving some changes, but even then it wanted consumers to pay for robocall blocking. The Trace Act will put an end to that nonsense. The FCC will be able to levy huge fines, although whether it actually bothers to collect them is a different matter. And phone companies will be allowed to block robocalls and are obliged not to charge for what should have been a basic service years ago. The statute of limitations on this issue has also been extended to 4 years, making it much harder for scammers to run out the clock on legal action taken against them. The speeches on the floor of the House of Representatives were full of fire and fury, stating that they will crack down harder on illegal scammers and really nail them. The huge, almost unanimous 417-3 vote certainly made it plain that the political will is there, and hopefully it will hold up and the FCC will see that it now has little choice but to come up on its years of empty promises. A most direct and effective approach is to make spoofing illegal. It won't eliminate robocalls, but it would certainly be a first step in cutting down on unknown callers. FCC will require phone carriers to authenticate calls by June 2021. The agency says the move will help combat the scourge of robocalls. The FCC announced that all carriers and phone companies must adopt a stir and shaken protocol by June 30th of next year. The regulatory requirement is designed to combat robocalls, specifically those that try to hide their phone numbers by allowing carriers to authenticate caller IDs. The agency says the widespread adoption of stir and shaken will reduce the effectiveness of illegal spoofing, help law enforcement agencies identify bad actors, and, most importantly, allow carriers to identify spammers before they ever call your phone. The FCC estimates fraudulent call schemes cost Americans approximately $10 billion, that's with a B, every year. The FCC started pushing carriers to adopt a protocol in 2018. Congress also mandated the technology when it passed the TRACE Act last year. While the regulatory requirement to support stir and shaken is a step in the right direction, it won't magically solve the scourge of robocalls overnight. It's not enough for carriers to merely implement the protocol on their own. They must also test that their implementation works with other networks. In other words, it's not something your wireless provider can just turn on. Moreover, as a consumer, you also need a device that can display the caller-verified notification when someone calls you. While most modern smartphones support the feature out of the box, other handsets will need to be updated. As a customer, will my network be expected to generate identity headers for traffic sent to bandwidth? Well, the answer currently is no. For shaken, as it's defined today, there are some use cases in which shaken as written needs to be augmented to address. One example of this is when a customer's equipment diverts a call that's call forwarding or transfer, which makes verification of the original identity header difficult or impossible. Another case is when a customer gets a number from one carrier and originates a call on a different carrier. Both of these cases, among others, are being debated in the industry forums and may result in a customer needing to generate an identity header or for bandwidth or third party to generate one on the customer's behalf. There is a more efficient alternative to stir and shake. It can be implemented immediately. That is to have the carrier disable spoofing completely. All they're doing is not to eliminate spoofing, but to only make it less palatable. Can't they keep it simple? All hands on tech from Marty Winston, retrofitting Frankenstein. Actually, he should rename it, anything that can go wrong will go wrong.
Sometimes the tale of a harrowing adventure is best told as if around a campfire. And such an adventure just happened here. So come on, gather around with a bit of your favorite legal and appropriate beverage as you hear about an old soul that dies three times before the fourth incarnation could take its first breath. You can call this retrofitting Frankenstein. Years and years ago, long time, years and years ago, a search for a death-defying PC led to a DIY build based on an extremely fault-tolerant RAID 6 array. RAID, you know, RAID, it lets multiple drives work as if a single volume. Well, RAID 6 can keep going even if two of its drives fail. This RAID 6 volume involves a total of 8 drives. They're small 2.5-inch enterprise drives, so they're going to run forever anyway. And one of the drives is just a raw standby in case any one of the other 7 will ever happen to fail. We were able to fit these 8 drives into a pair of 4-drive housings. Each 4-drive housing fits into a standard 5-inch disk bay. So even though there are 8 drives in this array, it all fits in 2 of those external 5-inch drive bays in our production PC. Their connection to the system is through a RAID host bus adapter. It uses intelligence on that card to handle all of the RAID functionality, takes a lot of processing away from the host PC. That's why this is a death-defying array. Not that that protects any of the rest of the system. That original system used a Core i7 processor and 64 gigabytes of memory. That's 8 modules, 8 gigabytes each. All of that was on an ASUS X99 Deluxe motherboard. It was never configured to overclock because overclocking increases heat and heat shortens life. So for years, it simply ran 24/7. Now, there were a few changes during that time. 2 very large capacity hard drives added internal backup and archive space. A new 2 terabyte SSD became the system's boot drive, made it boot a lot faster. And the original ASUS X99 Deluxe got replaced by an X99 Deluxe with USB 3.1. The DVD burner made way for a Blu-ray burner. Those were the changes. 1 year ago, that system started spontaneously rebooting near the end of a workday. A third-party service crew identified it as caused by thermal grease getting into the CPU pins. 2 service calls and 2 CPU cooler replacements later, we came to suspect that assessment. 24/7 came off the table. The system got shut down at the end of each workday, and it ran fine that way until about a month ago. Not even a month ago. During the middle of normal work or even just sitting there, the system would again spontaneously shut down. Once the system rested, it rebooted and would run for, initially 20 to 30 minutes. But later, and this was on the first day when we saw this, later the same day, it would reboot before getting all the way through the power on self-test. That's what's popularly called POST, power on self-test. Now, one thing that's important to understand about computers is that the most likely accelerator of failure is heat, because it prematurely ages components. The most likely trigger of a failure is surges on power or communication lines. And the most likely cause of the kind of failure that times out into spontaneous reboots, if not heat, lies in the onboard capacitors. If you've ever taken a halfway good look at a motherboard, those tiny cylinders on it are capacitors. Well, this system wasn't overheating. The CPU temperature wasn't getting that high, and a remote reading infrared thermometer showed that the CPU cooler was barely getting warm. It wasn't spikes either. There's whole house surge protection on the power lines, on the cable modem coax lines, on the Ethernet lines, and all the gear at the work desk is powered through a line of 8 uninterruptible power supplies underneath. There's yet another UPS in the short rack that houses all the IP and signal connections. It was not spikes. It had to be the capacitors. So, it was obviously prudent to find a replacement for that motherboard, a model that's not been available at retailers or online for years. We could use the same CPU and the same memory if we could find one. One site had one. Several days later, it was here, and we tried a transplant. Nothing doing. We couldn't get the boot process motherboard Q codes, just 2 alphanumeric characters that indicate the motherboard's current point in the self-test process. We couldn't get those, try as we might, we couldn't get those past 00. The seller said that the motherboard was tested and burned in for an hour before they sent it, but as far as we could tell, it was DOA, dead on arrival. So Frankenstein remained lifeless. We went to Micro Center, good people there. We told them what we needed in terms of PCIe lanes and slot count and so on. The only candidate was an ASUS, again, an ASUS Prime X299A. They had a returned unit for about $100 off. Of course, the old CPU wouldn't fly. The biggest and most expensive item in this build is the minimum Core 9 we could use, a 10900X. For the geeks, the deep geeks among you, here are some relevant specs. Cascade Lake for socket LGA2066, 3.7 GHz, 10 cores, 20 processing threads, 44 PCIe lanes, and 165 watts thermal. The German company, Be Quiet, had sent us 3 of their products for review. A Dark Base Pro 900 tower case, a 1200-watt Dark Power Pro 11 power supply, and a Dark Rock Slim CPU cooler. As long as there was a rebuild to do, they were all better choices than the original build's beat-up Antec case and time-worn 1,000-watt power supply unit. Firing up had a familiar outcome. A 00 Q code, DOA. It got returned to Microsatter. We moved to this address almost exactly a year ago, last April, and one of the cartons had elements initially planned for a project PC to go into a rack. It was hard to believe, but there was a never-used Asus Prime X299A in the box. Frankenstein was about to see its fourth motherboard in 2 weeks, and this one did not get stuck at 00. But there was a memory issue. The Core i9 CPU's spec sheet says it wants 2933. The motherboard's box says it wants 2666. The combo, the motherboard, the CPU, can handle speeds up to 4,000. So another deep plunge into the shrinking bank balance got four sticks of 2666 memory, totaling the same 64 gig we had before. Now that's worth some explanation. The tasks for this machine are not individually memory intensive, but there is a lot of intensive multitasking going on, mostly office applications and browser work, some simple work with photos, audio, and video. When it comes to memory for these kinds of operations, a bigger memory capacity outweighs faster memory. I'll repeat that. Bigger counts more than faster. Memory is something worth revisiting in a future segment. I think we'll do that. Frankenstein wasn't yet quite alive again. Not quite. Dozens of messages with Asus support, hours in support chat, baby steps, but with an analytical approach, multiple analytical approaches. It was a learning experience. One discovery was that the motherboard was blind to one of its memory slots. Let's give a mental map a shot. This processor supports four memory channels, and when it can find four, it can divide the processing up to each of the four pools, meaning there's only a quarter as much taking turns as with a single memory channel. The motherboard names those channels A, B, C, and D. Each channel gets two memory slots, numbered 1 and 2. If you put DDR4 memory modules in A1, B1, C1, and D1, it gets treated as four-channel memory, and that's where you should start. The four-channel approach is fragile, so it's best to populate evenly. Single-channel treatment isn't terrible, but four-channel is wonderful. So what to do? Asus does provide a way to tune its motherboard to its memory. Tune is their term for it, and despite having bought 2666 MHz memory, the system insists on treating it, after tuning, as 2133, a 20% slowdown. But remember, capacity outweighs speed. The original build had 2400 MHz memory, and since the motherboard was degrading the speed anyway, sticking in four of those to populate the unoccupied slots was effective in boosting the total memory footprint. Memory is something that deserves a closer look, its own segment, more about performance differences than about numbers, and that's in the works. The thrice retrofitted Frankenstein today lives again. Its central processor is newer and faster. Its power supply is rated for more power, meaning a longer life expectancy, and that now starts from zero operating hours. The case has more fans for better cooling, but net-net, it's quieter, and that's both because of the design of the fans and because of the design of the case. We have more kinds of newer generation USB available, as well as Thunderbolt. There's even a QI charger on the top of the case. Asus is the maker of all four motherboards mentioned here, but you should not consider the faults of those motherboards as reflecting on them. The first one ran 24/7 for years, and its eventual demise was unquestionably the result of old age, or at least the motherboard version of that, capacitor failure. Its replacement from an online source never got past 00 on its diagnostic display, the starting point before it goes through self-test. But they are issuing a refund and even paid the return shipping. The failed upgrade from Microcenter had been returned to them and discounted before we got it, and they gave a no-argument refund when we took it back. The one running Frankenstein right now will need to be replaced, and it's still under warranty. The challenge there is to break the rules. Normally, ASUS would issue a returned merchandise authorization, RMA for short. You return the product to them, they repair it and ship it back to you. But that would mean a month or more of added downtime here. So I am making some exceptional requests of ASUS, both through their support group and through their media relations group. A failed memory slot is something that is extremely unlikely to get repaired. So the request is to send a new same model motherboard before getting this one returned. With luck, they will find a way to allow that. Next time, the outlook is cloudy. No pun, it isn't very much about Microsoft Outlook, and by now, everybody knows that the cloud is a favorite feeding ground for hackers. But there are a few specific ways to find a safe and useful way to let very selected cloud assets play more of a role in simply staying productive. Join me, and we'll let a little sunshine break through.
Thank you, Marty. And by the way, go back to basics and keep things simple. The true superheroes of our time are the healthcare, police, fire, and first response professionals protecting our families. At 7 p.m. each day, thousands of New Yorkers open their windows, clapping, shouting, whistling, banging on pots and pans, more to show our appreciation. If you are listening to this program, live streaming on the internet, at the end of this program at 7 p.m., open your windows and show your appreciation for these workers. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups and heed the guidance of staying at home for this period of time during this crisis. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy, and remember, keep 6 feet apart, and until we meet again, same time, same station next week.